This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
CEO came in the late 80s and said, right, I'm going to make this company the safest company in America. You literally had hedge fund managers, people managing finances, run to the back of the room to pick up the phone and say, dump the stock, this guy's bananas. And you kind of then look 10 years on and the business is flying. Productivity is thriving. But at the time, people heard that speech and thought, man, this guy's crazy. Why haven't we seen another CEO take to the mantle and say safety is going to define this business for the future?
Hindsight's 2020. I do wonder whether the focus on safety was actually a proxy for showing care for people and whether these days that there are just different ways of showing care for people. I'm curious whether companies want to make huge, bold declarations in terms of understanding then the impact, especially to their share price and their market capitalization, if one doesn't hit those goals and targets. And I think we're starting to see that a little bit now with some sustainability goals.
And I'm curious, as a woman that has gone through such incredible career growth, incredible positions across so many different businesses, how have you found that your gender has had an impact in that? Has it had an impact?
The way that I was raised was this belief that you can achieve anything or do anything. So I probably also came into my career believing that I could be anything or do anything. Yeah. What I experienced along the way were barriers, preconceived ideas and notions about whether that's even possible. And so maybe that's why I also focused on the technical side as well as my communication, because I always thought if I can show credibility, then I get part of the conversation. Maybe you will invest further down the hierarchy of control in the short term because you can't get the money in the short term to fix it, but maybe you can get it in the long term. And I've just found as well that when you understand business context, you have more credibility because you're also understanding what the business leaders and the supervisors, what they're up against, and also what they're trying to do to be successful. Quite frankly, you know, when you're in a meeting or a room and all you've got to offer up is information about regulations or how to do a risk assessment or the hazards that people are associated with, it makes a boring conversation. I've always just found that by understanding different parts of the business, then you get to have much more interesting conversations with people. I try and be well-rounded on it. Yeah, definitely. I don't think that there were any courses that I attended that helped with that one. Maybe the biggest course, though, is experience.
Right. Hello, Megan. Thank you so much for joining us today for the episode of Rebranding Safety. Incredibly excited to have this conversation with you and kind of see what we get into. So, Megan, what can you tell us about just who you are? Give us a bit of an introduction, because I'm sure that there'll be a few people out there that won't have necessarily have heard your name before, won't kind of understood some of your background in safety. So, yeah, over to you.
Well, Peter, thanks for having me. It's really nice to talk to you today. So, yeah, I'm Dr. Megan Tranter. I have had the good fortune of working in some of the biggest companies in the world in the top EHS role. And it's always blows my mind how a little girl from Australia, and that's how I think of myself a lot, can move to the US and get these amazing career opportunities to work in these beautiful, brilliant, complex companies. Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about companies like PepsiCo, Amazon, Novartis, Netflix. Yeah. And I've just been really fortunate. Yeah, I would say fortunate in having the top global EHS role in those companies. And a lot of the time, not for all of them, but for a lot of them, those roles didn't even exist when I joined the company. And so it's been a real big learning and journey of how you get those roles, but also how you can perhaps build them yourself and just experience the beauty of working in these big companies.
Incredible stuff. I mean, I think that that might actually come to a surprise to quite a few people listening to this, that at, I'm going to call it the very top of the career tree for those positions that actually they haven't existed before. And it's something that you've helped carve, helped define, and helped bring an identity to across, I mean, literally household names that we're talking about here. Everyone's heard of PepsiCo, everyone's heard of Amazon, everyone's heard of Netflix. I must say, your LinkedIn is just incredible. absolutely incredible. And I appreciate that I didn't introduce you as Dr. Megan Tran to start with as well, but what's your PhD in?
My PhD is from the University of New South Wales in Sydney. And those type of PhDs are all thesis. There's no coursework. A very long title, but my thesis was on, and I have to remember it, it's up in my bookshelf, but the thesis was looking at occupational health and safety experiences of young, precariously employed workers in the fast food industry in the UK and Canada. So very, very specific. And actually, I'm quite amazed after all these years that I can still remember what it is. But I remember going to the UK and Canada and interviewing hundreds of people in each of those countries, and then spending many years. It actually took me almost 10 years to get my PhD because during that journey, I had three kids. I moved from Australia to the US. So there was a lot of stop and starts, and to actually get it across the line was nothing short of a miracle.
Wow. So just so that I've got this right, I mean, you're doing your PhD, you're working in a global position at the time, is that right?
Yeah.
And you're doing a PhD. I'll be honest with you. I mean, Megan, I've had twins recently. Some days it is a struggle to remember to put the same coloured socks on more than anything else. Again, the people that are listening to this, I'm sure that they'll have kind of questions that they might be shouting at the screen here. How did you manage that? How do you even begin to reconcile taking that very intense academic kind of approach, that very intense global position, and then everything that comes with motherhood? How do you even start reconciling that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So just going back to the PhD for a minute, you know, I started that when I was single, had no kids, and then I finished it married with three kids.
Yeah.
And I think it goes to show as well, you know, if you really want to achieve something, you have to prioritize things. Also accepting that sometimes things don't go the way you want them to go. When I started the study, I was convinced I would finish it in 3 years, that I would be this stellar student and finish it in 3 years. I had no idea that it would take me nearly 10. And even right at the end with that, I think I was so close to running out of time. There was a little bit of desperation as well to get it finished. But I think that maybe that's the piece that I've learned as well going along this path here, is that sometimes finished is good enough. You know, sometimes things look messy, or actually things might look neat and tidy on the outside, but underneath they're really, really messy. And you just have to keep going. And I remember there's a colleague, and she'll know who she is. She and I used to have this joke that, you know, we were the graceful swan sitting on top of the water whilst underneath paddling like anything, just to, you know, to keep things going.
But, you know, that sounds so, that's just such a great metaphor for health and safety as well. I mean, when everything works in health and safety, it looks so incredibly serene, it's beautiful, it's, I mean, God, you could just stare at it all day, it's great, it's wonderful, but underneath the surface there are managers, directors, advisors that are just paddling away, desperately trying to keep things afloat, but for the entire outside world it's just this one graceful department that's just plugging away and delivering what it needs to. I love that, absolutely love that.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's the complexity of being human. You know, you were asking me earlier about my career. I started very technical. So, you know, I studied health and safety at university. My first job was an inspector focusing on industrial hygiene and actually rural safety. So like going to farms in rural northern Queensland. And at the beginning, I was super technical. And then over time, I was able to adjust to get into more of these leadership type roles. Where you still need a level of competence, but you realize that being technically strong, although it's definitely good, it's not always necessary to be, you know, the number one person. And, you know, those who know me know that I was an industrial hygienist. And if you ask me to go out now and sling some pumps around and do some of that sampling, I don't think I'm your person for that anymore. Yeah. But, you know, it shows as well that during your career that you can zig and zag and morph and change, and it's all good because it's all part of understanding yourself and understanding what you want to do in your career. and, you know, getting those skills and experiences to be able to move those ways.
Wonderful. I'm just making sort of furious amounts of notes at the same time as part of this. And just to pick on kind of some of that career journey that you've made, where you have moved from sort of a more technical position to a leadership position, was there one particular jump through your career where it became very obvious to you through that jump that actually the world of technical is nowhere near as important as some of these other skills that you're needing?
Yeah, I think when I had the more junior roles, it was important to have good technical skills, because that's what I was hired for and that's what I was delivering. That was my impact.
Yeah.
And I think what it is it's just understanding that there are different types of roles. So it's not good or bad to be more technically strong or to be a generalist or a specialist, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It just depends on the role and the impact that you're trying to make in a point in time. What I found, though, is that as I started getting into roles that needed more influence on other leaders, whether it was country leaders or different parts of a business, as we mentioned earlier, you know, I've worked in really big companies and a lot of them are very complex and they're often restructuring and reorging. And so it's important to understand what is happening with the business, you know, what's important to the business, what their goals are, how they're organizing themselves, and also what is motivating those leaders. So I guess what I found was over time, you know, if you go into a conversation and you get into real technical safety speak, people aren't really interested in that. Yeah. So you also have to be able to talk as a bit of a human being and in a normal way and understand that, you know, some leaders, they don't need to know or want to know about the really technical elements of health and safety. And that's totally okay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to get the impact that you're looking for, you need different things out of them. You know, you need their commitment. Maybe there's resources that the business needs to control the hazards or to change the safety culture. But there are different things that those senior leaders bring that it's perfectly okay, in my opinion, that they don't, you know, necessarily know about control reliability of a piece of machinery equipment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've hit on so many good points there. Just to kind of recap what you've just sort of really covered there, it's thinking about impact, thinking about influence. Communication has really just resonated through that entire section that you've just talked about there. But communication across language, content, but really thinking about relevance more than anything as well. And I'm curious, but this is going to be a little bit of a bold question for a second. Now, I am a white heterosexual young male, right? That there are certain things that I will have automatic privilege for that means that I can have compassion for others but won't necessarily be able to sympathize because I simply don't experience it in the same way. And I'm curious, as a woman that has gone through such incredible career growth and incredible positions across so many different businesses, how have you found that your gender basically has had an impact in that? Has it had an impact? And has it forced you or kind of meant that you've had to change your approach in certain circumstances, especially when you're getting to that C-suite type of level?
I love this question because I tell you why I love it. So I'm one of four daughters. I don't have any brothers. I'm one of four daughters. And so the way that I was raised was this belief that you can achieve anything or do anything. So I probably also came into my career believing that I could be anything or do anything. What I experienced along the way was were barriers, were preconceived ideas and notions about whether that's even possible. And it did impact, you know, what I've done and how I behaved. And I'll give you an example. You know, I remember when my kids were young, so I had my first child and the second one 2 years later and the third one year after that. So I had three kids 3 years and under. And I remember, because I was working during the whole time, and I remember when people would ask me how my kids were, not wanting to have a focus on the kids. And so I didn't want to answer the question because I myself perceived it not as a positive. I myself wanted to be seen for the professional that I was and not as a mother. I do think that over time I've changed my thinking on that. And one of the things that I hope to do as a leader is to have a safe space for all people now. So, you know, no matter who you are, that you feel comfortable bringing your full self to work and that you don't have to mask or hide who you are. Yeah. But I've certainly experienced it over the years. And then also, you know, I remember getting into the, when I got into the profession and there are a lot of men in the profession. I think
there still is. Yeah.
And, you know, being questioned, who are you and who are you to be doing this or know this? And so maybe that's why I also focused on the technical side as well as my communication, because I always thought if I can show credibility, then I get part of the conversation. So people may judge me because of the way I look or what their preconceived ideas are. But if you can break through that and then you have the credibility, then people may be more likely to listen.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, a lot of people helped with that. And this is where, I mean, mentors are good, but I think sponsors are even better.
Okay. You know, what's the difference there between a mentor and a sponsor? Because it's not something that I'm sure a few of our listeners might have come across before.
Yeah, I didn't know the words either for a long time. Yeah. So a mentor is someone, and I don't necessarily have a good definition, but I'll just share my experience of it.
Yeah.
So a mentor for me was someone who I could talk to go to for advice. They might give input in certain circumstances or situations, and they were sort of guiding me as a friendly, but they were, it was more of a private conversation and relationship. What a sponsor was, and I think this was the biggest thing that helped my career, a sponsor was someone that was in a room when I wasn't, and they were the ones saying, yeah, you know, I think Megan could do this, or let's put Megan up for this project or this experience, or let's have her do some of this as well. And at the time, you often don't even realize that you have a sponsor there. Perhaps until someone else tells you later on that, yeah, you know, at that meeting, so-and-so, they said that you would have been great for this.
Yeah.
And again, I don't necessarily know how you find sponsors because, in my opinion, I don't know that you want to be that obvious about it. But when you can find people that appreciate what you're doing and they have that servant leadership type of mindset as well, they're the ones also that are speaking up for you on your behalf, putting you forward when you're not in the room that you don't even realize. But to me, that's been the biggest game changer. And that's what I've also tried to do for other people.
Yeah.
And people on my teams, they probably don't even know it, you know, that I was doing that for them. But it helped give them opportunities in their career as well.
I love that. I think that there's so much to be said for that advocacy element for other people, and especially those who are in the right, it's the right time, it's the right position for them to be able to take a step up, but it just requires someone to say, hey, let's give them a shot. They're ready. Let's do it. Let's put them in the game and see what happens. Yeah. So I think I absolutely love that piece on mentor and sponsorship. And to the point that you've said about it's about the conversations when you're not in the room. Is that kind of saying that someone's personal brand is what people say about them when they're not in the room? And actually that kind of tie with sponsorship there is really quite nice. And I know that if I think about kind of how do people not only advocate for others, but how do they advocate for themselves? Some of the best people that I know in health and safety are able to really tell a good story about who they are, tell a good story about some of their background, really add to the credibility by sharing some of the outcomes and the potentially the adversity that they've faced to kind of get to where they are. So I'm keen to get your take on this, especially sort of thinking off the back of that piece on sponsorship. Where do you see storytelling kind of fitting into someone really elevating their personal brand? And do you think that's even relevant these days?
I do think it's relevant. I think that people want a connection with other people. And so how do you get a connection with a person? How do you build trust with a person? How do you trust someone? You know, sometimes it's finding something in common with them. It may be doing what you say you're going to do. There's all different ways of doing that, right?
Yeah.
But the way for people to get to know you is for you to understand who you are as a person and to share that with other people. And, you know, I find as well that having humility and, you know, showing that you are an approachable person, that you have something in common with them, that you understand them, that you can empathize with them. All of that comes together in having good relationships with people. And, you know, I was writing a LinkedIn post the other day, actually. I love looking at different research papers, and not all of them are safety. And this one was about career success. And it was talking about the importance of social capital. And I think it was actually a term that I don't know that I understood all that well. And I don't even know if I understand it all that well now. But the way my brain thinks of it is, as a person, what relationships do you have with other people that can then benefit them and also benefit you? And this research was basically showing that skills and experience, while good, and absolutely very good, social capital may be even the bigger game changer for people in accelerating their career. And maybe it fits back to the topic about sponsorship and so forth. Yeah. But getting back to your point about storytelling, you have to be able to, you know, have a story. Everyone has a story. It depends on the time of the day and the day of the week, what story you want to tell. You know, you could tell a story about how sad something was or how difficult something was, and maybe that resonates and fits with a certain type of person. And then with a different person, you know, I think back to the business context, you know, it's the storytelling might need to be more around the impact or the advantage that you can make or have by having something in common with that business leader. So one thing I found is if you can adjust and be flexible with the storytelling and the communication style and trying to understand the person and what drives them, that that often leads to better success as well.
I love that point about the commonality with that. I often have a chat with people coming into the safety profession that say that they really struggle with networking. And they say, I don't know what to talk about. I've got no idea. I say, right, well, I was in a networking event recently and I just struck up conversation with the person behind me. And we started talking about queuing and got into a story each about times that we'd queued for food before. And before you know it, they've turned into someone that I've got a discovery call with. And one of my colleagues has sat next to me and she said, hey, I don't know how do you do it? How do you even get started with that? And it's literally, sometimes it is just a case of finding that common denominator that literally aligns both of you together in that moment in time, that either adds some entertainment, adds value through learning something new, or to be honest with you, in that case, it was just literally having a laugh at the expense of waiting for a cup of tea. But do you mind if can I put you on the spot for a second, Megan? I mean, you mentioned earlier on about how you'd even managed to create positions that didn't exist before. And if I could ask you, can you tell us a story, basically, just about how, what was that? Was there a particular kind of position that you'd done that for? And basically, what was it? And I mean, how did you do it? I appreciate that's quite a big question, but yeah, really curious if you can give us any insight into it.
Yeah, I think back to one of the roles I had where I was hired to look after the international operations for health and safety. So what that meant is I was living in the US. Actually, I was living in Chicago. And I had other EHS peers who looked after the US and Canadian, the North American businesses. So I was looking after everything else. And that itself was a first of a kind, a first role. And part of the reason for that is the business had decided that it didn't want to only be known for its brands, and it had grown through acquisition. It wanted to be known through the positive impact of the parent brand as well. And so what that meant from a social responsibility perspective was needing to bring together expectations and standards for different ESG topics, and one of them was health and safety. So I started in this role looking after international. It was a really good fit. It was actually a very fun job, traveling around the world all the time and meeting lots of people, seeing lots of cultures and lots of experiences. But it occurred to me, why would we not have certain things for health and safety globally?
Yeah.
And so I just started asking the question. And by asking the question, and also probably being in the right place at the right time, where the business goals and the business leaders themselves were asking similar questions for different topics, I, by myself asking the question, I was able to be the one that people said, well, what is the answer to that, Megan? And yeah. So I was able to partner with a very senior person, and we basically did, I would call it nearly a research project or a, you know, analysis of what the different structures and organizations and EHS standards were across the different businesses and countries, and then put together a proposal of what a future structure would look like. And so I worked on that with this other person. And then at the end of it, when I presented it to some really senior people, a little while later, they came back and said, we agree with what you're saying. Would you do this work? And I was delighted, because back then I wouldn't have put myself out there so far. I don't know if I said, and I would like to do this job. These days I'm more likely to say that, you know, I would like to do it. But I don't know if I did. But again, that was a door that opened for me by doing the work, by putting the analysis together, by presenting it, by showing the benefits and then also the risks of doing it. I think they were able to see in someone, well, this person, if they've thought it through and they've been able to collaborate with other people to do it, then that might be a good fit for them to actually execute it and work on it. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I absolutely love that. And I appreciate your humility as well, when you're basically saying that there is an element of luck as part of that, being in the right place at the right time, but very much underpinned by that hyper curiosity of just asking the question to start with. I think that's absolutely wonderful. If you don't mind me asking, was that other person that you collaborated with in safety, or were they in kind of another department?
No, the other person was in HR.
Really? Right. How did you find that? I mean, there's a bit of a trope, I'll be honest with you, in the UK about kind of HR in the context of how health and safety view them. But I'm curious, how did you find that relationship at that time, kind of working with H&S and kind of HR?
So this relationship was one of the ones that taught me a lot about organizational design, organizational structure, and also the massive impact and influence that other functions have, especially HR.
Yeah.
I started realizing after working with this person just this influence that they have over nearly every business. And I would hazard a guess that even smaller businesses, you know, that have HR functions, that they have the same type of impact and influence over the company. And so the joining together of the minds, if you like, you know, I think that was decided perhaps by someone else. And clearly, again, someone else more senior had wanted this topic to be looked at. And so I looked at it and the other person looked at it together. But we were also teaching one another, because the person worked for one of the businesses, I worked for international, so we weren't even in the same business line, if you like. And so, you know, the learning for me also was that people and opportunities will come up when you least expect them. And if you can grasp them with both hands, there's usually not much to lose, you know. But it does take courage sometimes. It's easy just to work with people that you know or that you feel comfortable with. And then you really have to go outside of your comfort zone and appreciate and understand that, you know, things are either going to work out well or they're not. That's the way I think about life lately. Maybe when I was younger, I didn't. But, you know, if you can think a little bit like that, then you do become more courageous and you're willing to think through what's best for people or the company or whatever.
Oh, brilliant. I think there's... I want to kind of just pick out something that you'd said in there, which is where you'd learn so much about organizational design and structure.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably fair to say for a lot of health and safety professionals, organizational design is a bit like black magic. I think there's actually quite a few people that might have heard of the term but won't have necessarily have thought, oh, I actually wonder how that fits into what I'm doing. When you kind of took that opportunity and learned all of those new skills, how important do you think those skills would have been earlier in your career? Do you wish that you'd known more about, for example, organizational design before that particular time? And is it something that you'd kind of recommend people who are early on in their career try and focus on if they think, oh, if I learn this, I'll kind of be able to unlock more opportunities in the future?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes, and it's a yes and.
Yeah.
I think that the more that health and safety professionals can understand the entire context of what they're working in, it helps you become a much more valuable and stronger health and safety professional. So to me, when you understand an organization's context, you can also figure out when to push and pull on certain things. So perhaps there's certain hazards that, you know, really bother you a lot and, you know, bother the employees a lot.
Yeah.
But perhaps the company doesn't have enough money to address them.
Yeah.
And so rather than going in all gung-ho and saying, you know, we need millions of dollars to put new machine guarding in, if you understand the organization's context and where they're at that point in time, then, and also if you have those relationships with different people from different cross-functional groups, then you can talk to them and say, yeah, like, can we do this instead or that instead? You know, I remember one of the companies I worked for had a really big fleet of privately owned vehicles. I actually think this company might have, at the time I worked for them, they had the biggest privately owned fleet in the world. Wow. And I don't know if they still do, but it was really big back then. And I started understanding what CapEx was and depreciation. And, you know, I didn't know this before, you know, that vehicles, according to different businesses, I think from memory, it might have been, don't quote me, but it might have been, you know, 7 or 8 years. And so once the vehicle is fully depreciated, they're basically driving it for free. You know, it's not costing from a accounting perspective extra. And so, you know, then when you're saying, well, let's go and put some reverse cameras in these vehicles, or let's do this or do that, you know, you understand that a vehicle that's only 2 years old, you may be less able to do that compared to a vehicle that's 10 or 15 years old and they were going to have to replace anyway. And then the new version of the vehicle has the reverse cameras on it.
Yeah.
Similar with things like, I use that example of machine guarding, but, you know, when capital reaches a certain stage of its life and, you know, it's not costing the business. I say it's not costing the business anything in inverted commas, and those who have a finance background will probably say that I'm wrong with this, which is okay as well. But my understanding of it was just that it's a different conversation about what you can fix or address safety hazards compared to if you're just going to do a few things at a point in time. Mm-hmm. So maybe you will invest further down the hierarchy of control in the short term because you can't get the money in the long, you know, in the short term to fix it, but maybe you can get it in the long term. And I've just found as well that when you understand business context, you have more credibility because you're also understanding what the business leaders and the supervisors, what they're up against, and also what they're trying to do to be successful.
I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't. There's something I tend to use as not a framework, but as just considerations, is time, quantity, quality, cost, capacity, and culture underpinned by capability. And for all intents and purposes, every operational issue or anything that's kind of happening at a very front-facing point of view will fit into one of those sort of 6-7 categories behind it. So it's not necessarily a case about talking about safety, but it might be a case of talking about compromised quality. For example, if we can't deliver on it, or actually, as you've kind of said there, it's not necessarily about the immediate cost as much as it's a long-term cost if we don't invest now. So the frame of sort of conversation isn't about coming to the board and saying, right, this is going to cost us X hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's actually, we're going to invest in it now because it will save us X amounts plus down the line. Now, I know that, that's a very simplistic kind of approach to look at things like return on investment, but as you've kind of progressed through your career, has it been kind of, where have you found that you've learned this from? Where have you found that you've kind of learned about sort of these bits around procurement, about CapEx, about return on investment, value on investment, all of these different things? Has there been kind of like a course that you've done, or has it literally just been absorbed from people around you?
No, not through courses.
I was going to say, if there was, please tell me which one it is, because honestly, I think they'd make a killing. They really would.
Yeah. Maybe the biggest course, though, is experience. And it's also working on projects or with other people on things that maybe don't seem relevant, but in the long term you learn from them. You know, I've always thought that the more that you can understand about how a business runs and, you know, really what's driving these leaders, then you can give better input yourself and you can have that understanding, you know, when it comes time to talking about safety stuff. Yeah. Also, quite frankly, you know, when you're in a meeting or a room and all you've got to offer up is information about regulations or how to do a risk assessment or the hazards that people are associated with, you know, I'm sure lots of your viewers talk about what it's like when you're at a barbecue or, you know, dinner and people ask what you do. Yeah. And if you say, I'm a safety professional, and they look at you and you're like, they're like OSHA and sort of like, well, I guess so. But, you know, it's when you're, when, the, if that's all you've got to talk about when you're at the lunch table with other people or whatever, it makes a boring conversation. Yeah. So I've always just found that by understanding different parts of the business, then you get to have much more interesting conversations with people. And you can, you know, as a person, you also probably have some good input, or as a customer of said company, you know, you might have some input as well. Yeah. So yeah, I try and be well-rounded on it. And yeah, definitely, I don't think that there were any courses that I attended that helped with that one.
It's a shame. It is a shame, but I genuinely love that bit though. It comes back to what you were saying about getting out of your comfort zone, trying to engage with things that don't necessarily fit within the wheelhouse of health and safety, but that you can still add value to. I remember there was one conversation I dealt with a few years ago as group health and safety manager with depots for food distribution. And I had this warehouse manager was literally pulling his hair out. He was absolutely stressed a bit. So I had a conversation and said, right, why are you stressed? He says, I'm picking all the time. I've got no time to do anything else. I'm struggling with the paperwork. It's just too much. So we said, right, okay. And actually something that I went through with him was outside of safety, and it was something from an environmental background, which is source, pathway, receptor, consequence. So I knocked off the consequence for a second and said, right, in this case, you as a person are the receptor. And if we would say, right, what can we do for you? Can we give you extra training? Can we give you a little mobility scooter to go around on so you're not running about type of thing, right? That's fine, but it doesn't solve the issue. So actually, if we were to look at the pathway, right, okay, can we, for example, give you an iPad rather than give you a bit of paper to start picking from? Can we put a conveyor belt to actually make the picking a little bit easier rather than using a pallet truck every time? Again, still doesn't solve the issue. So going back to the source, we said, right, well, your source of the issue is that we're doing day one for day one ordering. People call up to 8 o'clock in that morning of day one, and they can get a delivery by 3 o'clock that same afternoon. And it is crazy, because you are just struggling with the amount of staff that you've got, the capacity, you won't hit it. You're not hitting it. You're not hitting your operational KPIs. We're getting customer experience that's going down, and realistically, you're pulling your hair out. So we've got issues with people, process, and product. So what can we do? So can we actually stop doing day one for day one ordering as standard and say, we'll do day one for day two? So actually, let's engage with the customers. Let's see if they'd actually be up for putting in their order by 4 o'clock the day before. And then, okay, look, if push comes to shove and they've got a real issue and it's blindingly hot and these guys need to get some burgers that day for all the barbecues, right, okay, let's make the magic happen. But actually, as standard, if we do day one for day two, you end up coming into work at 7 o'clock, you know what you're doing, you can prep it out, and we can still work through all of those bits on pathway and receptor. So by bringing things upstream on a conversation that was not really about safety, but was actually about operational performance in the warehouse, we achieved safe outcomes. And we managed to roll that process out across a number of different sites. Because that's, for me, from what you've described there, that business context, understanding that context, framing it in that way, that's, I reckon that's where safety can make the biggest difference, if it's empowered to do so.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I talk about stacked wins and that means. Yeah, stacked
wins. I've not come across that before. What is it?
And what it means is that if you can make a change to a process or within an organization and you can get multiple positive things out of it, then that's where you stack the wins. And it's similar to what you were talking about. So perhaps you can improve productivity. Perhaps you can improve organizational health because people are happier with what they're doing. Perhaps there's an improvement to safety. Perhaps there's cost savings, you know, all of that. And then when you can start stacking the wins, that's also what helps you get the ROI. Because I think a lot of safety people, you know, we lament about how difficult it is to calculate an ROI, return on investment, with standalone safety initiatives.
Yeah.
You know, because the levers that you have to pull are so limited, but also not quantifiable. So if you can stack wins with other outputs and outcomes that have a solid ROI, then safety just becomes the final, you know, cream on the top, if you like, of why a business might decide to actually do something. And, you know, and then also the good thing with that is perhaps it's done for productivity, and not everyone loves the word productivity because of sort of the undertones of what it's really doing.
Yeah.
But then if it's a safety initiative, then many people really like that something is being done for safety because it's showing care for people. So, yeah, it's an interesting concept and one that probably has different names and terms as well, but it's always struck me. And it's where this, you know, working cross-functionally with other people comes in. Because as a safety person, if you're going it alone and all you're trying to do is pull the levers according to the hierarchy of control, I don't know that you're going to be that successful and that it's going to be super sustainable. But if you can get other people who also have a vested interest in whatever the change is that various folks are looking for, then I think that's more likely to be successful.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I don't want to kind of put you on the spot too much with it, but you've had such a range of different sectors and industries that you've worked in. And I'm sure that you've worked with a number of different, I'm going to call them just generations of safety professionals. So thinking about kind of the demographics, these are people that are coming in their early 20s through to people that are kind of in the late 50s, early 60s that are kind of still working in safety. Have you found that anyone that's sort of coming in at an earlier stage might be kind of saying, right, I want to really engage in this particular approach with safety, that more holistic type of thing? Or are you finding that a lot of them might play it safe? Have you found there's been any difference really in terms of how their generation has defined their approach?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. One thing I see a lot is and I've worked with teams, you know, like really small teams up to massive teams with thousands of safety professionals in the teams, just massive, massive teams. I think a lot of it relates perhaps more to the individual and their style.
Yes.
Rather than only saying it's generational, because you may get someone who, let's call them seasoned, who is more seasoned, but they have a certain style and a way of doing things that is perhaps not traditionally associated with their generation.
Yeah.
So there is one thing though about the generational question, and again, it's a really interesting question. I think it's important just to appreciate that different generations think a little differently and do things a little differently, and that being able to adjust to different people and their styles and what resonates with them is probably even more important. So, you know, there are some things that, you know, a person may have in mind, or perhaps it's super innovative,
yeah,
but it's just not going to fly with a cohort of people because they're not used to it. That being said, all it often takes is a couple of people in that cohort to say, well, let's give it a try. Or, yeah, I've seen this and I think this is a really great idea. And then you can get buy-in and move forward with it.
I absolutely love that. And there's a particular example that's just sprung to mind, right? Which is where it's probably, a few people will know it when I say it, but it's Alcoa, which is where you've literally had kind of the CEO came in the late 80s and said, right, totally different. I'm going to make this company the safest company in America. And you literally had sort of hedge fund managers, people managing finances, run to the back of the room to pick up the phone and say, dump the stock, this guy's bananas, right? He says he's going to make this company the safest in America. And you kind of then look 10 years on and the business is flying. Productivity is thriving. They've adapted insanely well to technology that's come out. They've adapted it really well within their business processes, not only for safety, but for operations as well. And it's just flown. But at the time, people heard that speech and thought, man, this guy's crazy. This person's absolutely mad wanting to do that. But it was so different. It was a very different style. It was a very different approach. I mean, I'm curious, you've worked in so many large organizations, these really big multi-billion pound organizations. I mean, in your opinion, why haven't we seen another Alcoa? Why haven't we seen another CEO take to the mantle and say safety is going to define this business for the future?
I remember when that happened, actually.
Yeah.
And it was such a surprise.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't remember other companies actually doing that before.
Mm.
I do wonder, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether the focus on safety was actually a proxy for showing care for people. And whether these days that there are just different ways of showing care for people, whether it's your employees or your customers or your clients, and whether companies are actually still doing something similar, but they're not using safety as the differentiator, but they're using different levers or different ways to show care. Because I do wonder about it a lot. I do also wonder... I'm a very curious
That's
person.
Right.
I'm curious whether companies want to make huge, bold declarations in terms of understanding then the impact, especially to their share price and their market capitalization, if one doesn't hit those goals and targets. And I think we're starting to see that a little bit now with some sustainability goals. So, you know, we're seeing companies that perhaps in the 2010s, I don't know how to say that in the right way, but, you know.
I think that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the 2010s were making really bold sustainability commitments. And some of them now are having to say, we're not going to get there. And the question then becomes, is it better that they're acknowledging that and saying, yeah, we were so audacious and we really believed we could have got there, but we're not going to be able, but this is what we have achieved, versus not make those public commitments in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really large company that a couple of years ago made some big commitments, and it's only literally a year or two ago made some big commitments about safety, yet I think it was wonderful that they made the commitments and they're working towards those.
Yeah.
Sometimes it becomes a little bit of low-hanging fruit to then criticize those companies when they don't achieve it. So I don't know. I think it's a really complex question. I like that you ask it because I think it's a really complex one. But I do wonder whether safety was the proxy for something else. It was innovative at the time, but is there a different way now that CEOs and others are showing that they care for their people?
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit so many wonderful points there. And I think actually, when I think about a company's doing something different these days, actually the thing that jumps to my mind is ESG, which has probably become, I'd say it's devolved into a bit of a buzzword in a lot of sort of Fortune 500 companies, but it is huge. it is absolutely huge, and safety is an element of ESG. To the point that you've kind of said about sustainability commitments that have burned people's fingers before or burned businesses' fingers before, I think that that's a really strong point. In this day and age, what I've seen is that managing sustainability across a supply chain, if we think scope one, scope two, scope three emissions, is incredibly difficult. If we think about, let's take electric vehicles for a second, we're literally talking about cobalt mining in third world countries that you end up going back to down the chain if you're trying to control emissions. I mean, at that point, you know, although I would love to see a Fortune 500 at the very top end here, maybe sort of like a Fortune 50 company, say, hey, I'm going to make our supply chain the safest it can possibly be, and take more of a societal engagement with it and say, actually, I'm going to take ownership because I understand that our impacts aren't just limited to our individual business. I genuinely think that the share price would tank, because the reality of trying to make that happen would almost be impossible, it feels. I've only ever seen it kind of done now with really small businesses. Are you familiar with, I want to say it's Tony's Chocolate, but I think it's Tony's Chocolone. You ever come across, you ever heard of it before?
Yeah, I like them.
I love them. I think it's brilliant. They've got a really good video. I think it's on Inside a Business, where they actually talk about what they try and do to try and mitigate everything from child slavery through to corruption, from coca plants. But when you start looking at it and you think, okay, a chocolate company who's making a chocolate bar is now trying to deal with systemic political corruption at a primary producer perspective. And you think, good God, is that really the responsibility of a chocolate company to try and tackle that at that point? That's a huge challenge, that now they're having to try and consider and engage with and work out at the same time as trying to just sell chocolate across the globe. I mean, so I think you're right. It's such a complex problem now that I'd be very surprised if we'll ever see another one, but I really appreciate your insights into it. Thank you. Oh, wonderful. So one thing that you, and Dashi touches quite nicely on it, that you talked about before, rather two things, were impact and influence. Now, I know from conversations that we've had that impact and influence are two things that are incredibly close to your heart, but how does this kind of fit into what you're doing next? And really kind of what's on the cards for Megan in terms of delivering kind of things in the future around helping people with impact and influence through their careers?
Yeah. If I start with influence, you know, I've been working in health and safety for, let's just say, many decades.
Yeah.
And I've worked with some people who've been wonderfully successful, and then others who've really struggled, you know, with the role. And I think a lot of it comes down to the way that we influence other people and our understanding of that, you know. And I'm not a psychologist, but I'm sure there's, you know, a little bit of psychology in all of this as well. And we always say in health and safety that it's an art and a science.
Mm.
But I think a lot of health and safety professionals focus on the workers and how do we support them to give them respectful work and a healthy and safe environment for them to work in. But the real decision makers are other people. And so, yeah, you know, the role of the health and safety professional, I do think, is probably one of the most influential roles and needs to be one of the most influential roles in a company, because it's not always the the favorite child, let's call it.
Yeah.
You know, and those of us who
work,
I'm trying to be diplomatic here. You know, I've led teams in sustainability, in risk management, in safety, environment, in a number of different teams. I've led tech teams, and you understand that aside from perhaps COVID, health and safety teams aren't always all that well respected, and many people feel this way. And hopefully, I'm not being offensive to anyone either. But my point really about influence is so many of us are absolutely devoted to this noble profession, you know, the way that we can have a positive impact on the world with people that we will sometimes never even meet.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know them, we don't know their families, but we're doing what we do because we genuinely believe that we can help people and make a difference in the world. So it becomes just even more important then for us to understand that the way that we do that is through influencing others. And there's just all different types of people in this world, all different types of styles, approaches, drivers that can impact the way that they will receive or not receive the messaging. And so maybe that links together to impact, because impact is a word that came to me through a previous boss I had a couple of years ago, and they were talking about, you know, the intended impact. And I wasn't really, I mean, I know what the word means, what the word impact is, yet it's like, is that really a appropriate word when you're trying to do work like health and safety? But I really think it is, because you're looking at the results, and the results don't have to be numbers. You know, a lot of people have plenty of thoughts and discussions about health and safety metrics and how you measure the success of health and safety. But there's also just this overall way of thinking, you know, if I put in this level of effort, what is the result of that? And what is the impact, whether it's positive or negative? And, you know, sometimes the impact happens really quickly, you know, and that feels really good. And then other times, and you'll resonate to this as a parent and those of us whose kids are getting older now, you know, there's that saying that the days are long, but the years are short. Yeah. And what you start realizing over time is that perhaps you think you didn't have an impact. So I've had these experiences where I've come out of a meeting and I've said to someone, well, that didn't go well. And they reply back to me, well, I think it went really well. And I said, well, tell me why. And then from their perspective, they saw different things than I did. So I had a certain expectation of what the outcome was going to be. But what they were looking at were incremental improvements and impacts that were being made, even just through a meeting or a conversation. And it doesn't always have to be the final endpoint. So I think about impact as, and I think this is something that health and safety professionals maybe could and should do a little more, which is reflect upon what are the short-term and the long-term impacts. You know, how are we making that? And how are we making a positive difference in the world? Because I truly believe we are in this profession, even though sometimes it doesn't feel that way, perhaps when we're not able to follow the hierarchy of control, and, you know, because that's what we're taught to do.
Yeah.
The other ways of controlling hazards, and, you know, it all still makes a difference. Perhaps it's not Gold Star or Rolls Royce level, but it does still have an impact. And, you know, if we think about that, then it makes the work so much more joyful, I think.
Yeah. God, there's so much to take from that. That's terrific, Megan. Thank you. I mean, I think the point that you've said about people's perspectives being different to what you think you've delivered is a really powerful one, where you have someone that's saying, we've got these little iterative improvements that we're making day by day. That's where the difference is. That's the change that is happening. And, you know, there's that saying that sometimes we don't see the wood for the trees. And to a point that you mentioned at the very beginning, which is, I think I've written it down, which is really about, it was almost like about perfection. Finished is good enough. That was it. And actually,
sometimes it is. And for those in the room, that are perfectionists, and I will put my hand up with this, sometimes it's a really hard pill to swallow to even think and contemplate that. You know, and when you're taught in health and safety, you know, that if the control measure isn't, you know, adequate enough to mitigate the risk, then these are the residual risk that is left behind. And no one wants to say, oh, well, that residual risk is okay, you know. And so I think it's quite a difficult thing to say sometimes. I have found myself that having worked in tech companies, and I've worked in a couple of tech companies where they do a lot of experimentation and iteration and improvement, I've become a little more open-minded to that compared to how I was at the beginning of my career. And it's, you know, it's a little difficult to say, I think, because you do want to, you know, you want to do everything so that someone doesn't get harmed, and, you know, so that you can build a strong safety culture. But at the same point, You know, do you have to sometimes wait just for too long to get something done because you're trying to have it done a perfect way? So yeah. I'm changing the way I think a little bit lately in terms of, you know, what is the advantage of experimentation? Can you try different things? You know, is that going to be enough, at least for a point in time, to mitigate risk? And then you continue to improve. And I think part of this also is just linked to the massive acceleration and speed of technology, even more now, you know, where, you know, if it takes you 6 months or 12 months to do something, there's a better solution after that. So perhaps it's okay to put a short-term fix in because you know that in a short amount of time, something better is going to be available.
Again, incredible points. And again, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm curious to ask a gender-based question for a second. I speak with a lot of women who are at different stages of the health and safety career that find themselves feeling that they either have to put in 1.5 times the effort, for example, that the male counterparts would have to do to get to the same outcomes, or they feel as though the environments that they work in automatically box feels the wrong word here, but it's the type of thing where a man might be described as being bold, but a woman might be described as being reckless when it comes around to experimenting because they haven't necessarily played it safe. You know, they've gone outside of the rules, they've gone outside of the box to try and achieve something. And for those individuals who might sort of feel like they are in these kind of, I'm going to call it just a two-tier system, let's say, for what it is, it's a two-tier system that they're working in. Do you have any recommendations for them? Do you have any advice for them in terms of how what they might be able to do within their sphere of influence or their sphere of control?
I love these questions. I think the stock answer is things like, you know, be really good at your job, set good goals, collaborate with people and network, build allies, work really well cross-functionally, blah, blah, blah. I think that's the easy answer. I think the more difficult answer is get comfortable with discomfort, get comfortable with making mistakes, get comfortable with, I hate to say it, but, you know, people not liking you. Get comfortable with finding the goodness and the achievements of what you've made and then understanding that you might need to make them somewhere else at a point in time as well. And someone like myself, you know, I find that really difficult. I try and do it more because you want to do a great job. And there are different standards for different types of people. That's sort of the way, the way the world still continues to work at the moment. But there are plenty of women, if we just focus on women for a minute, there are plenty of women out there who are incredibly audacious and just go for it. And so I think as women, we also need to try and worry a little less about what people think. And if it doesn't work out, fine, it didn't work out. And that's just the way it is. Move on to the next thing. But it's not easy. It's easy for me to say it, but then, you know, all of us have feelings and emotions and, you know, when something doesn't go well, we feel a certain way about it. But one of the things I have really been working on the last few years is trying to move out of certain emotions or experiences faster. And people who know me know that I'm not really a very emotional person. But what I've found is that I would receive feedback, and if I myself didn't feel the feedback was fair, it would take me a long time to work through it. And what I'm doing now is accelerating that to try and be more neutral and just say thank you for the feedback and look for the goodness. You know, if someone has given me feedback, it means that they've observed something that they're in their opinion they want to share with me. So whether I agree with it or not, I need to take it. And then I can, you know, if I can act neutrally about it, not feel happy about it, not feel sad or angry about it, just accept it as neutral. And maybe this is my, you know, yoga teacher training, because I've become a yoga teacher now as well. I don't know. It's funny, you know, going from a scientist to that. but it has helped me a lot because then I don't spend minutes, hours, days ruminating over what someone else said. I try and focus on what their intent was and that accept that feedback is a gift. And if they spent the time to think about me and to give that to me, that maybe there might be something in there. Equally, sometimes there's not. That's okay as well.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your insight there with that, Megan. I think some words to live by in terms of don't ruminate on what others' words are. Take what you can from it, move on, but think about where you can bring that impact and influence from that feedback and from what you want to deliver for who you are as an individual going forward. Because that very much fits into the style thing that we were talking about before in terms of personal branding, in terms of what we can deliver as safety professionals from that kind of initial technical level all the way through to those different leadership skills and the styles that not only complement our functions and our teams, but those around us, those in HR, those in operations, those in the supply chain, because ultimately we bring our whole selves to work, be that as someone who's gained a PhD, be that as someone who's a father, a mother, a safety professional that has just started, or someone that's been in for a couple of decades. And I think there's a lot to be said there for being proud of who we are as individuals and how those experiences really create our style and really create our USPs and what we're known for. Because it might just be that hyper curiosity, it might be that particular style of engagement, that brand of communication, that means that today we're in this role, but tomorrow we can literally make our own. So yeah, I've loved this conversation so much, Megan. And apologies, but I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up from a time point of view. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that have loved hearing us talk, loved having this conversation and being a part of it from the other end of the podcast or on the YouTube video. But what's the best way that people can reach you, basically, if they want to get in touch with you, they want to find out a bit more about what you can do for them, what you can do for their teams, what you can do for their businesses? How can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so the phase of my life that I'm in now is actually one of offering services through coaching, consulting, and so forth. Wonderful. So the easiest way to reach out to me is on LinkedIn. I'm Dr. Megan Tranter. I don't think there's any more of them on LinkedIn. Also on my website, megantranter.com. There's various ways to connect with me on there as well. And as I always say to people, I've started publishing a newsletter. Every Tuesday it comes out. It takes a lot of effort to write a newsletter each week. So please subscribe if you're interested in safety and leadership. But I always say, both on LinkedIn as well as in the newsletter, there's a person on the other end and the person is me. So don't be a stranger. Reach out. I'm having lovely conversations with people on LinkedIn, on phone calls, just chatting to people, seeing how they're doing. And it's been really, really lovely. So wonderful. Thank you so much.
Good. No, you're very welcome. And perhaps, is there any kind of closing thoughts, any final words that you kind of want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think the topic of safety and leadership, and for health and safety professionals, how you think about your career and what it takes to build a wildly successful career, is something that it's time for each of you to take agency over. And really, you know, no one else owes it to you. You really owe it to yourself. And there are so many amazing jobs in our profession and adjacent jobs as well, that I think every single one of you can have a chance of getting one of those jobs if you're interested in it at a point in time. So yeah, take the bull by the horns, really go for it, be courageous. Don't worry about what other people think, and I'm sure everyone will have the most brilliant career and the brilliant future that they can imagine.
Wonderful stuff. Dr. Megan Tranter, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for your time. Please, I do hope everyone gets in touch with you on LinkedIn, add you on LinkedIn, and definitely signs up to that newsletter, because I can promise you right now, you've got one immediate subscriber coming in by the end of today. Absolutely. Thank you once again. Cheers.
Thank you, Peter.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.